To the Hour of the Time, and I'm Pooh.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I am the...
I'm Doyle.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag, to the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, dear.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Allison.
Go cool.
Thank you, Doyle.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Daddy.
Okay. We'll see you guys later.
Okay, bye.
Now,
bye.
Don't forget, you got to eat all your beans, okay?
Right.
Okay, guys.
I'm eating my
puppy dog. All right. We'll see you in just a little bit. Well, good evening, folks. It's day number two on our new station, WBCQ, Monticello, Maine. I guess it's Monticello, Maine, isn't it?
I would think so, yeah.
USA. And Doyle and I are going to be with you for 3 hours again tonight. And we've got a fantastic program for you here. We're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence, the men who wrote it, the men who risked their lives to implement it, and the men who suffered because of all of these actions. Sometime during the last hour of the broadcast, we're going to open the phone, so you might want to jot down the phone number. It won't do you any good to call until I tell you the phones are open, because we will not answer the phone. The number is 520-333-4578. So later during the last hour of the broadcast, or whenever we get around to it, we will open the phone for anybody who wants to call and comment or talk or whatever you want to, I don't care what you talk about, whatever it is. So the number is 520-333-4578. One more time, 520-333-4578. That's also the number that you need to call during the day sometime to find out about shipping costs on some of the merchandise that we offer. I can tell you right now that some of it, well, you absolutely have to call us, and we have to fax your location off to the drop shipper to find the shipping costs. And so we'll work with you on that and make sure that it's the lowest cost that we can possibly get for you. We also, folks, for those of you, where is it? There it is. We've also, for those of you who may be experiencing a little problem receiving the shortwave signal, I don't care where you're at. In shortwave, it's not the cost of the radio that counts. In fact, a $10 radio will perform just as well as a $5,000 radio if you have the right antenna. Mm-hmm. With most radios, that's always going to be true. The deciding factor in shortwave, folks, is always the antenna. Now, from the reception reports that we've been getting, what have we been getting, Doyle?
Well, some of them are, they got a scale of 1 to 7, and they're going 20.
Now, most of the people that we've heard from, who have given us reception reports, have told us that the signal of WBCQ is coming in like gangbusters mm-hmm. everywhere. I mean, it's off the scale, mm-hmm. which is just incredible. I've only had one report from somebody in, I believe it was Virginia, who said that he wasn't able to get the signal clear. I don't care where you're at. If you have the proper antenna with the strength of this signal, you're going to have no problems hearing this broadcast. So we've put together a little antenna, folks, and it is exactly, well, for those of you called Ramsey and you're going to get your Ramsey catalog, it's the same thing that Ramsey has in their catalog that they're charging you $46 for. We put it together with the insulators and the copper wire and the lead in, everything that you need, as a matter of fact, to hook up a top-of-the-line, really good long-wire antenna to your radio, and we've got it here for $24.95, and that includes shipping. So that's post-paid. If you want to improve the reception of your radio, send us $24.95, and we'll send you this antenna kit, and you can put it together yourself in about, about maybe 30 minutes to 45 minutes, and have yourself a number one top-of-the-line antenna. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do it is arrange it as a dipole, and you can just tack it to the side of your house, or you can run it around under the eaves outside your house. You can do it any way you want to, folks. It's got a good set of instructions with it. It's got all the insulators and everything you need. So let me give you the address for that. It's Hour of the Time, 101.1 FM. That's in care of 101.1 FM. Post Office Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's the Hour of the Time in care of 101.1 FM. P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. I want to thank all of you who have sent email and have called telling us that that you really enjoyed the broadcast last night. I had so much email, I couldn't believe it. And that that you're looking forward to more programming of the Hour of the Time. I was particularly pleased to hear that there is not a state in this union, including including other countries and other states outside of this union, that can't pick up this broadcast really clear. I've heard from people in Mexico. I've heard from people in Canada. I've heard from Hawaii. I've heard from a gentleman in Japan. I've heard from three people in England. And all of them were listening to the broadcast last night. They loved it and said that they had no problems receiving it. Now, I have no idea. They didn't tell me what radio they had or what kind of antenna they had, but this is just incredible because the strength of the signal is really strong. For those of you listening on 101.1 FM, if you want to, if you have a shortwave radio and would like to tune in the broadcast on worldwide shortwave on WBCQ, the frequency is 7.415 megahertz or 7415 kilohertz. I don't care how you want to express it. You just dial that in on your shortwave dial, and you'll get us loud and clear. If you are experiencing problems, send us $24.95, and we'll send you out an antenna kit really quick, and you'll be glad to get it. It is the same thing that Ramsey and others sell for up to $46. So in concert with our promise to you, we are keeping the price lower than all of those other people. And I guess that's about it for that. Today, folks, tonight, I think I've already told you, we're going to talk about the Declaration of Independence. We're going to begin in the beginning. That's the best place to begin, is in the beginning. And I think a lot of you are going to learn a few things tonight. And I hope you learn something on every broadcast of the hour of the time, because that's our intention, is to teach you, to open your mind, to dispel the myths and the lies and the disinformation, the misinformation, the intentional warping of the mentality of the average American. You see, I don't believe in Republican and Democrat. I don't believe in black and white and yellow and Native American and Oriental and all of this baloney. We're all either Americans or we are not. And if you're an American, you must subscribe to certain principles and ideals of freedom, because that's what this country is all about. If you don't, you don't belong here. You don't belong here. There are other countries where you can go and be a socialist or a communist or a, what else is there? A fascist or a dictator or a, or you can have your own little theocracy for all of you who want to shove your religion down everybody's throat. You know, like the dude that was on before us. We don't subscribe to any of that. Our founding fathers set up this nation so that everybody could be free. And if you want to be free, you've got to understand the principles and ideals upon which this nation was founded and the protections of the creator-endowed rights that every man and woman is born with and are entitled to and are protected by our Constitution and a lot of other things that you have to understand. There is a tremendous concerted effort to try to destroy those things so that mankind can once again be enslaved by those who just can't ever exist without shoving their ideas and their religions and their philosophies down the throats of all other people and enslave those that they manage to get within their grasp. And so the purpose of this broadcast is to bring all of these things out to you. Send them out through this microphone, over the airwaves, into your radio, out through your speaker, and so that you can take a look at them. Now, I'm going to give you my admonition once again. You see, we don't want you to blindly believe what we tell you. We want you to learn to think once again. To question. I don't know how many people I talk to all the time who tell me that they learned all about the philosophers in college and all this, and the truth is they really didn't, because anymore about the only thing that they teach is Kant, Hegel, and Marx, and they don't teach anything else, because the coming New World Order, the coming world government, the coming third wave that Mr. Toffler talks about all the time is socialism. It's Marxist, Leninist socialism, and it's being brought about through the antiques and the teachings of Kant and Hegel. So anyway, this is what's going on, and if you can't get your mind out of that, you see, I talk to these people, they tell me they learned all about the philosophers, and I ask them, what did you learn about Socrates? And they go, oh, yes, we know about Socrates. Well, what was it that Socrates taught? And, they tell me something about you should go to your death nobly because it's the law. And that's not what he taught. What he taught was to question everything, not accept anything at face value, and not trust people, specifically public servants or members of government, to tell you the truth. You have to learn how to wade through all of the baloney and find the truth for yourself. And so we give you facts and figures, and we give you things to go and look up, and we hope that you will do that. Because if you're trusting me to tell you the truth, you're doing the same thing that you've done with everybody else all your life. How in the world would you ever know whether or not I was lying to you? I can tell you right now, I'm not going to do that. Although I will make mistakes from time to time. And if I make a mistake and any of you catch it, and if you can prove it to me, and by that I don't mean call me up and say, well, you made a mistake and this is the way it should be. send me something in writing so that I can double-check what you're saying and find out whether I really did make a mistake. And if I did, I'll come on the air and correct it. I've never failed to do that, folks. So, but I don't want you to trust that I'm going to tell you the truth just because I say that. And if I make a mistake and you're trusting that I'm telling you the truth and you take that mistake as the truth, then you've compounded all of these, whatever errors there may be. And that's not good for you, and it certainly isn't good for us. So we want you to take whatever information we give you and go out and research it. Study it. Find out if it's true or not. And if it is, and you've been living according to something else that you thought was the truth, you're going to have to change your life. You're going to have to change the way you live. You're going to have to change the way you think. And that's what this broadcast is all about. It's about setting you free from the prison of your own mind. It's about expanding your consciousness. It's about letting you know what freedom really is so that you can be free and so that you can give the gift of freedom to others. Because most people are walking around in this world, they haven't got the slightest idea what freedom means, but they talk about it all the time as if they do. And they spend most of their life actually trying to confine other people in their own type of prison. And this causes conflict. They spend their lives dividing themselves against the rest of the world. I'm black. Black power. Whitey did this to me. I'm a Native American. And the white man and the capitalistic magnates who wanted our land did this to me. I'm a white man, and now I'm a minority because of affirmative action, and I can't get a job, and everybody hates me because I'm white, and it's not my fault because I never owned a slave. I'm a Democrat, or I'm a Republican. I'm an independent. I'm a libertarian. Let me tell you something, folks. If we don't stop that and get back to being Americans, it's going to soon be all over and there won't be any freedom. Because the process of all this division creates polarization. It creates people who then have an agenda and they're trying to enslave other people with their agenda. Instead of all realizing that our common bond and our common agenda should be, must be, and has to be freedom. Because if it's not, the most glorious, the ultimate achievement of all humankind in the history of this world is going to be destroyed. And that was the creation of this nation by the founding fathers that finally set man free for the first time in the history of the world. It had never happened before. And if we blow it, and if we lose it now, I can tell you right now, with the state of modern technology that can be used by a dictator or a tyrant or communism or fascism, which are all in the same corner of the world and on the same side of the ruler that measures all of these things, freedom will never, ever again be within the grasp of the common man. So, while you're thinking about that, we're going to do this, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to do the Declaration of Independence. So, get ready. I think you are going to learn something. At least I hope you're going to learn something. I really, sincerely, truthfully hope that we all learn something, including me. And every time I do these broadcasts, even though starting over at the beginning, I'm going to learn something tonight too. I'm not sure exactly what it is yet, but I guarantee you it's going to happen because it never fails. Don't go away. I'll be right back after this very short pause.
Oh, beautiful. for spacious skies, for amber waves of rain, for purple mountain majesties above the moon's plain. Oh, America, America, God shed His face on thee.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the early days of this nation, we were under the rule of King George of England. Most, and some say all, of those who came to these shores left what they called the Old World for the New World in order to escape some type of persecution. Many of them were criminals who faced long prison sentences. Many of them were indebted so badly that they were indentured and had to work off their debt, literally as slaves, to a master on some plantation or in some colony or town, as an apprentice or helper in a blacksmith shop or working in the fields. Some of them were not indentured, were truly slaves. Many of them were escaping from religious persecution of some type. Life in that time, ladies and gentlemen, could be terribly cruel. And the average lifespan of almost anyone was very short. Most people do not realize that the United States of America existed before the Declaration of Independence was written. Most Americans today do not understand that this country was created before the Constitution was ever written, debated, approved, or adopted by the first 13 colonies. And there are many people today who believe that the first number of the colonies were exactly 13. And of course, that isn't true. If you ask anyone schooled in American history the question, who was the first president of the United States, I can guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, that even school teachers who should know better would respond with the answer of George Washington. And the fascinating fact is, they would all, each and every one of them, be wrong. Wrong. You see, the United States existed as a sovereign nation more than 14 years prior to the effective date of the United States Constitution on March 4, 1789. March 4, 1789. Now, for most people, that is a revelation of tremendous magnitude, something that they had never been taught in their whole life. The Continental Congress, you see, first convened on September 5th, 1774. 1774. On July 12th, 1777, Congress began review of the Articles of Confederation, which were drafted by John Dickinson. They were adopted by Congress on November the 15th, 1777, and submitted to the states for ratification. When Maryland ratified the Articles of Confederation on March 1, 1781, the United States of America had its first instrument of government, a constitution. John Hanson of Maryland was elected President of the United States in Congress assembled in recognition of his significant role in obtaining its adoption. John Hanson was the first president of the United States, not George Washington. In fact, George Washington sent a letter to John Hanson congratulating him for his appointment to fill the most important seat in the United States. Now, there's a reason why this has been dropped from the history books. There's a reason why school children are not taught these things today. You see, the reason is that the Articles of Confederation are still in effect as law today. The Articles of Confederation were created in perpetuity, which means forever. History has also failed to account for six additional presidents of the United States in Congress assembled under the Articles of Confederation, as well as seven others who were presidents of the Continental Congress. Here are the presidents of the Continental Congress. Peyton Randolph of Virginia, 1774. Henry Middleton, South Carolina, 1774. Peyton Randolph, Virginia, 1775. John Hancock, Massachusetts, 1775 and 1776. Henry Lawrence, South Carolina, 1777. John Jay, New York, 1778. Samuel Huntington, Connecticut, 1779 and 1780. Thomas McKeon, Delaware, 1781. And then the first president of the United States of America, John Hanson of Maryland, 1781. The second president of the United States of America, Elias Boudinet, New Jersey, 1782. Thomas Mifflin, Pennsylvania, 1783, was the third president of the United States of America. The fourth president was Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, 1784 and 1785, known in history as Light Horse Henry Lee. The fifth president of the United States was Nathaniel Gorham, Massachusetts, 1786. The sixth president of the United States was Arthur St. Clair, Pennsylvania, 1787. And the seventh president of the United States of America was Cyrus Griffin of Virginia, who held his office in 1788. George Washington, ladies and gentlemen, was actually the eighth president of the United States of America. The president of the United States and Congress assembled at that time was more equivalent to today's Speaker of the House. He lacked the independent status, authority, and power under the Articles of Confederation to have any leadership effect on government actions. You see, Congress was in all respects both the executive and legislative branches at that time. The Confederation government had no authority to regulate commerce and trade among the states and with foreign nations, and it had no taxing authority. It lacked necessary trading and shipping treaties with Great Britain. There was no national currency. Banks printed their own money. The common coin of the realm was actually a Dutch thaler, which over the years became pronounced dollar. The association of the states could be characterized at best as the disunited states of America. States printed their own paper money that was not backed by gold or silver. It was not interchangeable and often became worthless. All but two of the 13 colonies had their own navy. The national government was insolvent and couldn't even pay the interest on the debts of the American Revolution to domestic and foreign lenders. These issues, coupled with adverse British regulations on American trade and shipping, eventually led to the Great Depression of 1785. The nation was in a disastrous financial condition. Most of Europe fully expected the United States to completely disintegrate. On September 11, 1786, 12 commissioners from five states, now listen to me carefully, 12 commissioners from five states met for 4 days at the Annapolis Convention held in the Maryland State House. The stated purpose was to discuss reform of the vexatious restrictions placed upon interstate commerce by the various states. Now, nothing was ever resolved on this issue from that meeting. James Madison, however, persuaded the states in attendance, with the assistance of Alexander Hamilton, that the political evils of the day were directly attributable to commercial deficiencies within the Articles of Confederation. The delegates joined in a resolution calling for a constitutional convention to be held in Philadelphia in May of 1787 to, quote, take into consideration the trade and commerce of the United States, end quote. Congress on February the 21st, 1787, issued a resolution stating, quote, that in the opinion of Congress, it is expedient that on the second Monday in May next, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states be held in Philadelphia, and listen closely to this, folks, for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union. That's why they don't want you to know anything about what went before. Because, you see, the Articles of Confederation were never abolished. They were just added onto by something called the Constitution for the United States of America. All of this began, ladies and gentlemen, in Congress assembled, the Congress of the United States of America on July 4th, 1776, with the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having, in direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance, unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with the power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and to consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that, as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The signers of the Declaration of Independence, ladies and gentlemen, John Adams, Massachusetts, age 40, died in 1826. Samuel Adams, Massachusetts, age 53, died in 1803. Josiah Bartlett, New Hampshire, age 46, died in 1795. Carter Braxton of Virginia, age 40, died in 1797. Charles Carroll of Maryland, age 38, died in 1832. Samuel Chase of Maryland, age 35, died in 1811. Abraham Clark of New Jersey, age 50, died in 1784. George Clymer of Pennsylvania, age 37, died in 1813. William Ellery of Rhode Island, age 48, died in 1820. William Floyd of New York, age 41, died in 1821. Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, age 70, died in 1790. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, age 32, died in 1814. Button Gwinnett of Georgia, age 44, died in 1777. Lyman Hall of Georgia, age 45, died in 1790. John Hancock of Massachusetts, age 39, died in 1793. Benjamin Harrison of Virginia, age unknown at the time of the signing, died in 1791. John Hart of New Jersey, age 63, died in 1780. Joseph Hughes of North Carolina, age 46, died in 1779. Thomas Hayward Jr. of South Carolina, age 30, died in 1804. William Hooper of North Carolina, age 34, died in 1790. Stephen Hopkins of Rhode Island, age 71, died in 1785. Francis Hopkinson of New Jersey, age 39, died in 1790. Samuel Huntington of Connecticut, age 44, died in 1796. Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, age 33, died in 1826. Francis Lightfoot Lee of Virginia, age 42, died in 1797. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, age 44, died in 1794. Francis Lewis of New York, age 63, died in 1803. Philip Livingston of New York, age 60, died in 1778. Thomas Lynch Jr., South Carolina, age 26, died in 1779. Thomas McKeon of Delaware, age 42, died in 1817. Arthur Middleton of South Carolina, age 34, died in 1787. Lewis Morris of New York, age 50, died in 1798. Robert Morris of Pennsylvania, age 43, died in 1806. John Morton of Pennsylvania, age 52, died in 1777. Thomas Nelson, Jr. of Virginia, age 37, died in 1789. William Paca of Maryland, age 40, died in 1799. Robert Treat Payne of Massachusetts, age 45, died in 1804. John Penn of North Carolina, age 25, died in 1809. George Reed of Delaware, age 42, died in 1798. Caesar Rodney of Delaware, age 46, died in 1783. George Ross of Pennsylvania, age 46, died in 1779. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, age 31, died in 1813. Edward Rutledge of South Carolina, age 26, died in 1800. Roger Sherman of Connecticut, age 55, died in 1783. James Smith of Pennsylvania, age unknown at the time of the signing, died in 1806. Richard Stockton of New Jersey, age 46, died in 1781. Thomas Stone of Maryland, age 34, died in 1787. George Taylor of Pennsylvania, age 60, died in 1781. Matthew Thornton of New Hampshire, age 62, died in 1803. George Walton of Georgia, age 36, died in 1804. William Whipple of New Hampshire, age 46, died in 1785. William Williams of Connecticut, age 45, died in 1811. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, age 34, died in 1798. John Witherspoon of New Jersey, age 54, died in 1794. Oliver Walcott of Connecticut, age 50, died in 1797. George Wythe of Virginia, age 50, died in 1806. If you were paying attention, ladies and gentlemen, you will have noticed that most of them died as young men within just a few years of having signed the Declaration of Independence. And you're going to hear all about that right after the top of the hour. Now, it is absolutely imperative that you understand that everything we have today, we owe to those men. Everything. Without exception. They created the freedom. They created the nation. They recognized that all men are created equal, endowed with certain unalienable rights. By their Creator. Everything they did was based upon those basic principles. And every bit of law that they wrote and passed into being was created to protect the rights of the individual. And that resulted in a people living truly, completely, and entirely free, responsible for their own actions, under law, kings and queens in their own right, for the first time in the history of the entire world. It created the greatest nation that has ever existed in the history of the world, with the highest standard of living, the best education, and with the ability over the years to complete the work of the founders. In many, many other areas, and by many other methods, including, ladies and gentlemen, doing away with slavery upon this continent, including eventually granting the right to vote to all people? And a whole lot of other things. Without their actions, with the foundation of principle and ideal that they recognized and set down in the law, without the protections given to the individuals under the Constitution for the United States of America, none of that could have ever occurred. None of it would have ever occurred. And that is what you must understand. We'll speak on other nights about society as it existed then, how it existed, why it existed, who is to blame for what, and why it should not be carried over into this time today. There are many people who have a vested interest and a solid agenda that by dividing us amongst ourselves, against ourselves, they will once again enslave us all. That's always the end result. United we stand, divided we fall. The only agenda that belongs to Americans, I don't care which Americans you are, is the agenda of freedom. That is the only way. That we can all be happy, that we can all live together, that we can all realize the great dream that the Founding Fathers set into motion with the Declaration of Independence. It is the ultimate achievement of all humankind that we recognize this. I am amazed when I see people who came from a history of persecution setting out to persecute others. It pains me deeply. And I know where it will take us, and I know exactly how it will end. And that must be avoided at all costs, under any and all circumstances. It must be recognized by all Americans for exactly what it is, a manipulation to lead us down the wrong path, right back into the chains from which we have been breaking off our ankles for hundreds and yes, even thousands of years. The Founding Fathers understood human nature probably better than anyone who have ever lived upon the face of this earth. They warned us what would happen if we did not remain eternally vigilant. They warned us what would happen if we sought security from the government. They warned us what would happen if we allowed governments to have standing armies amongst us. They warned us what would happen if we were not responsible for our own lives. They warned us what the penalty would be if we accepted gifts from benefactors. George Washington, in his farewell address, warned us about getting involved in the affairs of other nations, other states, foreign to these shores. And sure enough, all of their warnings were right on target and absolutely true. And what have we done? We've cast their warnings aside like so much moldy bread and gone ahead and done every single thing that they have warned us against. You think about that while we do the station break here at the top of this hour. And then We're going to tell you what happened to those men who signed the Declaration of Independence, what they gave up for us. And we owe them everything that we are and that we have and that we ever could be. You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. The story of the Declaration of Independence, ladies and gentlemen, is something that is not taught anymore. And I hope your children are sitting in your living room listening to this broadcast, because tonight you're going to hear a little about it. You're going to hear about the enduring truth of its philosophy of freedom, the underlying courage and sacrifice required of its signers. John Adams said in 1781, and I quote, "This immortal declaration of the 4th of July, 1776, was not the effect of any sudden passion or enthusiasm, but a measure which had been long in deliberation among the people, maturely discussed in some hundreds of popular assemblies and by public writings in all the states. It was a measure which Congress, the Continental Congress, did not adopt until they had received the positive instructions of their constituents in all the states. It was then unanimously adopted by Congress, subscribed by all its members, transmitted to the assemblies of the several states, and by them respectively accepted, ratified, and recorded among their archives, so that no decree, edict, statute, placard, or fundamental law of any nation was ever made with more solemnity or with more unanimity or cordiality adopted as the act and consent of the whole people than this. And it has been held sacred to this day by every state with such unshaken firmness that not even the smallest has ever been induced to depart from it, although the English have wasted many millions and vast fleets and armies in the vain attempt to invalidate it." End quote. The Pennsylvania State House, ladies and gentlemen, was hot. It was humid. And it was charged with emotion as representatives
from the 13 colonies came together in June and July of 1776 to consider severing their allegiance to an oppressive government and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. Every single man felt the enormous significance of the moment. In a June 9, 1776 letter, John Adams confided, and I quote, "Objects of the most stupendous magnitude and measures in which the lives and liberties of millions yet unborn are intimately interested are now before us. When these things are once completed, I shall think that I have answered the end of my creation." End quote. And each man knew the dangers he faced. Already, two revolutionary leaders, John Hancock and Samuel Adams, faced the scaffold if caught by the British. For to England, these men were traitors. All knew that if their mission failed, they too would be hanged for treason. And as John Adams noted in a letter to Abigail, the declaration was, in fact, an act of treason. And if it were not made good, those who had signed it stood a good chance to incur the penalty meted out to traitors. But the signers of the Declaration of Independence were not, ladies and gentlemen, rabble-rousers. They were, as patriots are today, responsible leaders and these men were from the 13 colonies, men of vision, men of high standing in their communities. 25 were lawyers or jurists. 11 were merchants. 9 were farmers or large plantation owners, and there were also doctors and educators. You see, a war was already in progress as they gathered in the Pennsylvania State House in a sweltering, hot, humid room with doors and windows tightly shut and pledged their lives, their fortunes, and risked conviction for treason in order to gain liberty for themselves and you, their posterity. They formed a committee on June 11th to draw up a declaration. The members of this committee were John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. Jefferson, whose writing skills were acknowledged by the other committee members, was chosen to draft the declaration. Looking back on the event in 1825, Jefferson recalled that their purpose had been to provide an appeal to the tribunal of the world. This, he said, was the object of the Declaration of Independence, not to find out new principles or new arguments, not merely to say things which had never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent and to justify ourselves in the independent stand we are compelled to take. In other words, he explained, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind. All its authority rests then on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, expressed in conversation, in letters, printed essays, and in the books of public right, such as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, et al. And now, on July 3rd, the declaration was almost ready. Jefferson, you see, had completed a second draft, and only a few minor alterations were needed. Decisions on the final wording was near. One delegate, only one, Caesar Rodney, who had gone back to Delaware on an important errand, was summoned for the vote. Suffering from an advanced case of facial cancer, he nevertheless rode horseback all night long in the rain, arriving late in the morning for this crucial decision, which no one would vote upon in his absence. there was much heated debate, because not everyone was convinced that the time had come for a formal severance of all ties with the mother country. John Dickinson spoke eloquently and persuasively of the need for restraint, warning of the calamities that might follow should they fail. The delegates, or at least some of them, were wavering when Edward Rutledge prevailed upon John Adams to speak out in support of independence. This was a crucial moment. Adams rose to the occasion. He made an impassioned appeal to reason that restored the resolve of the representatives to risk everything, all that they possessed, in support of independence. Making no false claims, Adams spoke with candor and told the member, "If you imagine that I expect this declaration will ward off calamities, you, sirs, are mistaken. A bloody conflict we are destined to endure." The mission, dear listeners, was accomplished. And what was to become the greatest nation in the history of the world came into being. The spirit of liberty, which had taken root on American soil more than 150 years earlier and had flourished in the American mind, had now expressed itself to the entire world. Adopted on July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence became the fundamental statement of the basic principles and timeless truths upon which the nation was to be established, and was, in fact, the first document in law. 11 years later, the framers of the Constitution of the United States of America would, by that document, establish a new government upon the principles set forth in the Declaration. By so doing, they would translate the philosophy of the Declaration into a constitutional structuring of a government of limited powers based upon the consent of the governed, designed to secure the individual's creator-endowed rights of life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. When the Declaration was signed, William Ellery of Rhode Island stood where he could watch each man affix his signature. "I was determined," he wrote, "to see how they all looked as they signed what might be their death warrant. I eyed each closely. Undaunted resolution was displayed upon every countenance." Such, ladies and gentlemen, was the strength and courage of our founding fathers. No one today remembers all of that. It's not taught anymore. Very few understand or realize the hardships that the men who signed that document faced and indeed underwent after the act itself was performed. These were indeed brave men who were loyal to principles and ideals and accomplished what no humanity had ever accomplished before in the history of this earth. For the first time, each and every man stood as a sovereign king in his own right, with the government as his chattel servant. Each and every person, it was recognized, were endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable, natural, irrevocable rights, protected by the first document in law, the Declaration of Independence, and then later the Articles of Confederation, and finally, the ultimate of their genius, the Constitution for the United States of America, and the first 10 amendments, which we know today, for those of us who know it, the Bill of Rights. And the price that they paid, these men who gave us all that we have or ever will have or have ever known, was staggering. posterity. You will never know how much it costs the present generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you will make good use of it, said John Quincy Adams. Posterity, ladies and gentlemen, is you. You are their posterity. John Quincy Adams, the son of a revolutionary leader, knew firsthand about the hardships of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. Future generations have also come, those of us who have studied it, to appreciate the great personal sacrifices they made to win freedom for themselves, their families, their countrymen, and you, their posterity. You, the sheeple, who are in the process of giving it away. It is little wonder, therefore, that Americans have traditionally revered the extraordinary men who gave us not only independence, but also the greatest system of government ever known to man. Ever. To the American people, at least until the present day, they were known affectionately as the Founding Fathers. Today, they would be called right-wing, religious fundamentalists, militia member terrorists, by those who enjoy the freedom, the fruits, the benefits, and the results of all that they've suffered. And I'm going to tell you now the accounts of their suffering, each of them. Listen carefully. For they gave up all, everything. So that you can whine and complain and stick out your hand like little children to the government to protect you. While you scream about patriots and militiamen who are out to get you, whose only interest is in the preservation of what our founding fathers created and gave to us, for these men and women of the modern day, who follow in the footsteps of those who created this great nation, understand that to give it up is to give up the ultimate achievement of all humankind and revert back to the position of slavery. In early September in 1776, the British burned the home of Francis Lewis, and they seized his wife. Held in a prison with no bed and no change of clothes, she was finally released after 2 years of suffering. Her health was gone, and she died soon after her release. Lewis, though heartbroken, continued to serve in the Continental Congress until 1779. He died in 1802. At the age of 89. He gave everything for you, and you never heard of him until tonight. Philip Livingston's 150,000-acre estate was seized by the British, but he continued to contribute his dwindling fortune to Congress for the war effort. He financed the beginning of this nation. The strain of the revolutionary struggle also depleted his health, and he died less than 2 years after he signed the Declaration of Independence. How many of you ever heard of Philip Livingston? Or Lewis Morris, whose Westchester estate was ransacked by the British, and nearly 1,000 acres were burned. His home was destroyed, his cattle butchered, and his family driven from home. Morris also served in the New York Senate and died in 1798 at the age of 71. John Hart's New Jersey home was looted and burned, his grist mills destroyed, while he eluded capture by sleeping in caves and forests. His ailing wife died and his 13 children were scattered. His failing health forced him to leave the New Jersey legislature in 1779, and he died less than 3 years after the declaration was signed. Joseph Hughes of North Carolina, though at first reluctant to favor independence, gave tirelessly of himself to create a navy and help General Washington He worked long hours without adequate food. He lost his health and died in 1779 at the age of 49. Richard Stockton rushed home to Princeton, New Jersey in 1776 to rescue his family from approaching British troops. He was captured and thrown into prison, where he was repeatedly beaten and kept near starvation. The British also destroyed his home and burned his papers. And as a result of his mistreatment, he became an invalid and died in 1781. William Floyd's estate in New York was overrun and ruined by the British. Although he could not return to his home during the 7 years of the war, he gallantly served his country in the New York Senate and as a representative from New York in the first Congress, and then he died in 1821. Francis Hopkinson's home was twice ransacked. But his enthusiasm for the war effort never wavered, and he remained in Congress throughout the Revolution. His artistic sketch of the Stars and Stripes led to our official United States flag. But the years, ladies and gentlemen, had taken their toll, and he died suddenly in 1791 at the age of 53. Abraham Clark also served in Congress throughout the war. He had two sons in the Continental Army. That's a fancy name for militia. Both of whom received harsh treatment from the British after they were captured. Clark continued to serve his country in many ways, and he was elected a delegate to the Federal Convention of 1787 that produced our Constitution. He died at 68. Caesar Rodney, the one upon whom they waited while he rode through the night, became a major general in the Delaware militia. Militia, 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 militia. And if you're a puke-faced communist, liberal, thug, Marxist scumbag, I hope that word makes you sick. Militia, 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 militia. He became a major general in the Delaware militia. And despite his advancing facial skin cancer, fought beside his men in the bitter winter of 1776 and 1777. He also served in the Delaware legislature and was appointed to the Congress in 1782. Declining health kept him from serving, however, and he died in 1784 at the young age of 55. Thomas McKeon recalled to John Adams that he was hunted like a fox during the Revolution, and at one time was compelled to move his family 5 times in just a few months. He served faithfully, however, signing the Articles of Confederation, serving as President of Congress, Chief Justice of Pennsylvania, and as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and finally as Governor of Pennsylvania. George Clymer's home in Chester was taken over by the British. Although he lost more than 100 of his ships during the Revolution, he dedicated himself to raising money for the war effort, working closely with his friend, Robert Morris. And in 1781, Robert Morris issued over $1 million of personal credit to finance the war effort and raised $200,000 from friends to defeat the British at Yorktown. In 1798, his personal finance collapsed, never reimbursed by his country. He spent 3 years in a debtor's prison. Discouraged and in poor health, he died in 1806. How many of you have even given $5 or $20 or $100 to help us save what these men gave their all to give to us? John Morton was criticized bitterly by many of his Pennsylvania neighbors for breaking the tie vote of the Pennsylvania delegation in favor of independence. The criticism depressed him deeply. Early in 1777, he became ill and died. Among his last words were these, and I quote, "Tell them that they shall acknowledge it to have been the most glorious service that I have ever rendered to my country," end quote. William Paca of Maryland poured thousands of dollars of his own personal fortune into clothing the American soldiers. He worked to establish Maryland's government and served as governor from 1782 to 1785. William Ellery's Newport home was burned during the invasion of Rhode Island. He nevertheless continued to serve his country. William Williams sacrificed his fortune for the cause, financing a number of enterprises, including the Ticonderoga offensive. Carter Braxton saw virtually every merchant ship he owned sunk or captured by the British, and although he lost his wealth and was forced to sell his land, he continued to serve in the Virginia legislature. Lyman Hall's rice plantation was destroyed by the British, but his family escaped to the north. George Walton was wounded and captured. After release, he served as governor and chief justice of Georgia and as a United States senator. Thomas Hayward, Jr. served in the army and was taken prisoner. The British raided his plantation while he was in prison and burned his buildings. His wife became ill and died before he was released. Arthur Middleton was captured and imprisoned after the British ravaged his plantation. Later, he served in the Congress, and in 1788, he contracted a fever and died at the age of 44. William Hooper of North Carolina was hunted by the British. He fled, and they burned his home and lands. Hooper served in the North Carolina legislature, and in 1770, he died at the age of 48. That should be 1790. The numbers are reversed here. In 1790, he died at the age of 48. Thomas Nelson, Jr. served as governor of Virginia and distributed large sums of his money to the families of his soldiers. At the Battle of Yorktown, he led 3,000 Virginia militia against the British. At the Battle of Yorktown, he led 3,000 Virginia militia against the British. Although the British took refuge in homes belonging to Virginians, Nelson's troops shelled them anyway. During the engagement, Nelson turned one cannon on his own home and lit the fuse, killing the two British officers inside. After the Revolution, his health declined and he died in 1789. How many of you would do the same? At the time of the signing, John Hancock, one of the wealthiest men in the 13 colonies, was one of two colonial leaders up to that time who were wanted for hanging. He too pledged all that he had for independence and signed his name so boldly that even today a signature is referred to as a John Hancock. He did it as a flaunt to the king, for the king had sentenced him to death upon capture. The other leader on the British wanted list was courageous Samuel Adams, one of the few representatives of truly modest means. He proudly affixed his name and, risking all, gave his entire life in service. The sacrifices and services of these men and their families are typical, ladies and gentlemen, of the price which an entire generation of brave Americans were willing to pay for freedom. Payne, Thornton, Whipple, and Bartlett gave their lives for this nation. Oh,
The inspired document, ladies and gentlemen, had come from the pen of Thomas Jefferson.